Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 27, featuring a thought-provoking conversation with grassroots organizer Dolores Huerta. We discuss organizing a movement, improving the lives of others, and educating the next generation of activists. I hope this episode leaves you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Today's guest has accomplished so much in her life, and I'm excited to share this powerful interview with you. Dolores Huerta began her career as an elementary school teacher, shaping the lives of young students. However, she realized that in order to help these students, she would need to help their parents too. Many of her students' parents worked and lived in terrible conditions while laboring in California's Central Valley. Dolores Huerta went on to create the United Farm Workers of America with Cesar Chavez and started a local movement which would dramatically improve the lives of farm workers nationwide. After retiring from the United Farm Workers Union, Dolores refocused on nurturing and developing the next generation of grassroots organizers through the Dolores Huerta Foundation. Just as Dolores encouraged farm workers to fight for change in their communities, the Freedom Writers and I wish to empower you to fight for change in the classroom. We hope that through thoughtful discussion and engagement, we can help you make a difference in your classrooms and your communities. Dolores' journey from teacher to activist certainly inspired us, and I hope that our discussion inspires you to start a movement of your own. Just as Dolores went directly to people's homes to spread the message of her movement, we at the Freedom Writers Foundation hope that each episode of the podcast is worthy of entering your sacred space, whether that be your home, your office, or your classroom. In order to make our podcast more impactful for you, our listeners, we encourage you to actively participate in our production process. You can let us know what you think by leaving a review of the show in whichever podcast app you use, by sending us an email at podcasts@freedomwritersfoundation.org, or by sharing episodes with friends. We love making these episodes for you and hope that we can continue to improve each episode so that our movement can grow from room 203 to every corner of the globe. Dolores still works in California's Central Valley, and as they made the drive to Bakersfield, the sky opened up. The raindrops fell in the fields that surrounded me on either side of the highway. I thought about the workers who'd been in those same fields not 10 minutes before, and how their livelihoods had been changed by this woman with whom I was about to speak. I wondered how many of them knew how close they work to the mother of this movement. After arriving at Dolores' office, we began to set up our equipment, and I was lucky enough to speak with her talented team. While we consider our guest a legend and an icon for her work with the United Farm Workers Union and her dedication to human rights, she prefers to be called a grassroots organizer. Dolores Huerta, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What I love about your story is you are still fighting the good fight. We are in your office and there are signs and posters and initiatives that you are still passionately fighting for. But I understand that a lot of that passion comes from your childhood. As a young girl, looking up to your mom, what kind of lessons did you learn from her about working hard and overcoming obstacles?
I think I was very blessed because my mother, you know, she was a businesswoman. She was a single parent. She and my parents divorced when we were very small. But she worked two jobs to be able to open up her own restaurant. And she always taught us from the time that we were children that if we saw people that needed help, that we had an obligation to help them. And not to wait for people to ask you. And so that's the way that she raised us. As a businesswoman, she was very charitable. She was always helping people in the community. I was a Girl Scout from the time I was 8 to the time I was 18 for 10 years of my youth. I was active in the Girl Scouts, and my mother became one of our Girl Scout leaders also. And in her role, she always reached out to the poor children in our community. And I didn't know this until my mother passed away, but I had many parents came up to me and said, "Your mother paid for my daughter to be able to go to Girl Scout camp." One of the reasons my mother was so strong is because my grandmother, her mother died when my mother was only like 5 years old. And she was raised by her older sister. And I don't know, she was always had an independent streak on her from the time that she was very young. even just to have the courage to divorce my father. He was abusive, and so she left him. I was born in the state of New Mexico, and so she brought us all to California. We were just kids, a single parent with three children, and working two jobs, you know.
It's amazing.
And, so she was always a powerful force in our family.
Tell us about why you stepped away from being an elementary school teacher to working with the families. I read that you were not comfortable with just feeding hungry kids and giving them shoes. You wanted to go to the source, go to their parents.
Right. And it was sad to me because I would see so many of these children. By the way, a lot of these children were Anglo children, whether the children of the Grapes of Wrath people, the Okies, as we call them. And I remember one particular school where I was teaching, the principal was from Arkansas. So I thought, well, he could relate to some of these young kids that would come into the classrooms. And he would say to me, oh, well, you know, all they do is, these are children of farm workers, all they do is drink up their money. You know, he says, that's what they do. They spend it on alcohol. And well, I knew some of these farm workers, and I knew that that simply was not true. And then the teachers, you know, when we would be in the lunchroom, they would be talking about their new cars. They would be talking about their vacations, about how they were going to be spending their money. And then when they would talk about the children, they would start criminalizing the kids. So you're talking about second, third grade kids. The kids were already tagged, you know, that they were going to be bad kids. I just hated to hear those comments. So what I would do in those days, you had to do schoolyard duty as part of being a teacher, you know. And so what I did, I just took the schoolyard duty every day. I didn't want to sit in those classrooms and hear these teachers malign the kids. And because, you know, I was a mother then by that time, too, and I had children, and they wonder if somebody says this about my kids, you know?
I think what you were exposed to very early on was poverty and racism,
right,
simultaneously.
Exactly.
And I would love for you, talking about when you're saying maligning, the horrific things that you heard from people who had power and authority. That must have been devastating.
Yes. Also, I remember once we had a teacher's forum, and they started talking about these Latino kids and the parents don't care about education. And I remember speaking out and defending the kids and saying, well, sometimes they have to take them out of school because they need to have a translator, or something happens at home that the kids can't make to school. And then everybody shunned me. Nobody would talk to me. After I spoke out, it was like everybody just avoided me, like I had done something really, really wrong. So you learn the lessons about speaking out. But once I learned about organizing, then I felt, well, the way to change this whole situation that I'm living right now is to get out there and organize the parents, you know, organize the farm workers, and to change the situations of poverty. Because one of the things that we did when we first organized our first chapter of the community service organization is go door to door to register voters, and then going door to door and going to the homes of some of these farm workers and seeing the extreme poverty that they were living in, you know, and then seeing their children in the classrooms. I said, wait a minute, you know, this is wrong. Something's got to be
what
done
I'd
here.
I'd love to paint a picture for our listeners, because a lot of them are students. Mm-hmm. Many of them are teachers. Describe in the late 50s, now we're in the early 60s, what kind of grassroots organizing you were able to do, as you said, going door to door, and folks who didn't have a voice, mm-hmm, feel that you gave them a platform to have that voice.
Well, the way that we organized, that Mr. Fred Roth Sr. taught us, is that we talked to people in their homes. And this is the method that we still use to organize people today. And so you ask someone to invite their friends or family members to their house and their neighbors. And we try to keep the meetings very small, from 6 to 8 people. And then we talk about the issues. And you talk about the issues, but then you talk about how we can solve the issues. And we can give them examples of people that look like them that have solved these particular issues. And then we try to get a commitment from them. Do you want to change the situation? Do you think that it should be changed? How many of you are willing to commit to help us make the change? And the way that you can help us, by having another meeting. And so we do a whole chain of these house meetings. And like even today in our organizing, each one of our organizers has to meet with 200 people in their homes, because that's how we get the commitment. Then we bring them all together and we form a chapter. We call them United Neighbors, Vecinos Unidos, right? And then once we get them all together, then they have to spell out the priorities that they have in their neighborhoods and the things that they want to get fixed.
Let's go back to those homes. It's early 1960s, mm-hmm, and there's great poverty in the Central Valley of California. What were some of the things that these neighbors were saying were the problems? And let's talk about how you helped them come up with solutions.
Oh, some of them were so major. And it's kind of interesting that we're seeing a repetition of some of those issues today. During the 40s and the 50s, they had brought in a lot of people from Mexico under what they called Public Law 78. It's now called the H-2A program. It's a foreign worker program where they bring people in from other countries to do agriculture. Well, the wages were very, very depressed. I mean, farm workers were earning like 50 cents an hour. In fact, we tried to get a minimum wage bill passed for 50 cents an hour in the Congress, and then head of the Senate, Lyndon B. Johnson, opposed it. So we had to fight, how do we get rid of this program, because the local farm workers were being totally displaced and they couldn't even work, and the wages were so low, you had this horrible poverty. So one of the things that we did, we started organizing to get rid of this foreign worker program, and we did. We ended the program in 1962, I believe, or 63, around there. Immediately, the farm workers' wages went up, and then it made it easier for them first to go into farm worker organizing. So both Cesar Chavez, as you know, we both left the community service organization and started organizing the farm workers' union. Today in the Congress, they are trying to pass a law that all, 'cause right now we have the same thing, that we've had these massive deportations, and a lot of the farm workers that were here that were undocumented have been deported. And these are mixed families. So you might have one member of the family that's a citizen or that's a legal resident, but then you might have an undocumented person. So you lose the whole family. You know, the whole family has to go back or the family has to be split. But right now in the Congress, we have the minimum wage laws now in the United States of America. And they're trying to reduce the minimum wage for these foreign workers. So here we have, it's kind of going back to the future. You have the same situation happening now that was happening way back then.
I don't think a lot of our listeners might know the origin of a phrase that was your phrase, the si se puede. A lot of people don't realize that was you. You created that. So tell me about the light bulb that went off, that you realized, I need to galvanize people, I need to give them something to say.
Well, it actually didn't happen like that. The way it happened, it was a very spontaneous response of mine to a group of professional Latinos who we were trying to get to join us when Cesar Chavez was doing his second 25-day water-only fast in Arizona. And when I met with these professional Latinos, and I was asking them to support us and to come down and to join us. Cesar was in the middle of his fast. We were having a mass every night and a rally every night. And they said to me, no, we can't do that. In Arizona, no se puede. In Arizona, you can't. Only in California. And my response to them was, si se puede in Arizona. And that night when I went back and reported that to the whole group, we had this meeting every single night, and people all stood up and started clapping, si se puede, si se puede. So it actually came from the universe.
You know? It was authentic. I have chills hearing it come from you.
Well, actually, there was a young man who is now an attorney in Arizona, and he told me he was in the audience that night, and he said, when you said si se puede, and everybody started shouting si se puede, he said he felt chills.
And I want to go with that, with feelings and passion, and you're also so principled. You always talk about your spiritual stance, that in the Latina community especially, that there's a deeper spiritual stance. So can you talk about that?
Right. And it's interesting, though, because I think that the fact that, especially in the Latino community, as you just mentioned, you do have a strong spiritual connection. And I think that made it easy for us to organize. Many of the farm workers are Catholics, and even the evangelicals, they all kind of worship the Virgin of Guadalupe, who was the Virgin Mary when she manifested herself in Mexico to an indigenous person. So anytime that we had marches or on the picket lines, we always had a banner of the Virgin of Guadalupe. And it was interesting because when we were in the middle of the strike, the growers went to court to try to get an injunction against the Virgin of Guadalupe. They didn't want the Virgin of Guadalupe banner to be on our picket lines, and they didn't want us to have T-shirts that said Huelga, strike, on them. Needless to say, they lost that argument on First Amendment rights.
For those young people who are not familiar with the formal strike, the Delano Grape boycott, and your dear friend and colleague, Cesar Chavez, can you take those young listeners back to those days where you were part of a movement pushing forward to make things bigger and better?
Well, I think we're still part of that movement right now. And one of the things, like yourself, that I have been pushing for in all of my speeches that I make, I do a lot of lectures at universities, etc. We have to teach labor studies. We have to teach labor studies in all of our schools. We have to teach about the value of people who work with their hands, the people that feed us, like the farm workers, the people that make our clothes, people that make our furniture, people that make our automobiles. These are the people that really create the wealth of the nation. They're the ones that make the nation work. And yet, in our educational system, unfortunately, we don't honor those people, the working class people. So I think the farm workers movement in the documentary on Cesar and myself, that teaches people about this. But I like to talk about May Day. We know that May Day is a national holiday all over the world, except in the United States of America. But May Day started in the United States of America. This is how we got the 8-hour day. But how many people know that? It was a riot in Chicago that was actually instigated by some of these Pinkerton police. They were like security people. People were killed there. But the big rally that they were having was the workers should only have to work 8 hours a day. What happened to the labor leaders that started May Day? They were hung. They were executed. Everybody in America, this is part of our lifestyle, having an 8-hour day, having weekends, but none of us know their names. This bigotry that we have in our society where we really worship people that are millionaires, but then we look down on people who feed us. When we talk about the boycott, it shows people power. Because sometimes people think, well, you need an army to make change. But oftentimes, that army starts with a couple of people. So when we started the Farm Workers Union, it was Cesar Chavez, his wife Helen Chavez, and myself.
The three of you.
Yeah. And little by little, we had got more people to join. Then when we did the Great Boycott, there were 40 farm workers that left Delano, California, and spread all over the United States of America and organized volunteers, not just farm workers, but there were a lot of young people that dropped out of school and that joined us, and then they were boycott leaders also. Those 40 people were able to organize 17 million Americans to not eat grapes.
We'll go backwards. You said you were going into homes, 5, 6, 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
So in a home with 5 to 8 people,
mm-hmm.
to 17 million.
Right.
How does that make you feel as your trifecta expanded, that ordinary people can do extraordinary things?
Well, if we look back on history, it's always been the ordinary people that make the changes. You know, whether you talk about the women's movement, LGBT movement, you know, if you talk about the peace movement, it's always been the people at the bottom, the labor movement. You know, and now we have seen that happening with the young people now, with the March for Our Lives, the young people from Parkland, Florida, that have gone out there against gun violence, you know, Black Lives Matter movement, the Me Too movement. You know, it's always the people on the ground that really make the difference. But the one thing, let me just make a cautionary note on that. And we did see that in this last midterm election, that it was translated into political action. Because sometimes I think that's what gets lost, is that people think, oh, we can do all these protests, we can do all of these marches, but if we don't translate that into getting people elected that are going to turn our movement into legislation, then it really doesn't change. So especially for young people, they really have to understand the importance of that, the importance of voting, you know, and finding out exactly what's going on in your community. Like, we're both very interested in education. Well, who are these school board members that are spending this money, appropriating the money that we get from the state legislatures? Are they using that money the way that they're supposed to be using it? Is that money, like in California, we have what we call the special concentration funds. This money is supposed to go to low-income students, to English learners, to foster children. Are they spending that money the way that they should? So with our organization, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, that is what we are focusing on, organizing the parents. Let me give an example. When we first got into this whole issue of organizing the parents, in our high school district, they had something about a parent center. Well, where is it? Where is it located? The money was there, supposedly, but guess what? Now they have 10 parent centers, okay? So, I mean, this is the power of the people. So that's what we have to work on.
But I love that you are this activist, grassroots and otherwise. But that's scary sometimes. Change isn't overnight and it's not easy. So I'm sure that your life has been threatened. I know you've been brutally by police officers outside the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. As a woman, were you fearful of what could happen to you? Because you're also a mother to movement, but also a mother to all these beautiful kids who are also part of the movement. So talk about that, your safety and your well-being. When and how is it threatened?
Well, when we do this kind of work, we know that you're taking risks. But on the other hand, we only have one life to live on this earth, and we need to make changes while we're here. I mean, we have to, all of us, feel that when we leave this earth, we leave it in a better way than when we got here. And so I think that if we let fear stop us from going forward and from doing what needs to be done, then nothing would ever change. But I think we have an obligation. You know, Senator Robert Kennedy, his last words before he was assassinated, he said, "We have obligations and responsibilities to our fellow citizens." And I would love that we all take that to heart. Mm. And that being civically engaged, caring about what happens to our kids in these schools, you know, that is an obligation and responsibility that we have, especially to our children, because the children are, I say, they're not only the future, but they're also the present.
Going back to that idea of taking risks and battling fear, for a lot of our international listeners, they might not realize that you were literally the person who walked Robert Kennedy through the hotel to get to the stage. He had just won the primary in California on the night that he was assassinated. So for someone who has taken great risks and to be in the trenches with other fighters, what was that like to lose people?
It's a tragedy when we lose people like Robert Kennedy. And also, you know, in the farm worker movement, we had 5 people killed. And the first one was a young student, actually. Her name was Dan Friedman from Boston, and she had joined a picket line of farm workers in Florida in a sugarcane strike, and she was run down by a truck. She was our first martyr. She was, I think, only 18 years old. Then we had our second martyr, who was a young Arab named Najid Aifala, and he was 21 years old, and he was murdered by a police officer, one of the sheriffs here in Kern County, right here. And then our third one was Juan de la Cruz. He was here from this area here, from Arvin, which is a little town down the road here. And he was shot in the heart with a bullet while he was on the picket line. And Rufino Contreras, who was met with a hail of 80 bullets when he went into a field in Calexico because he went in to talk to strikebreakers. And then our last one was another young person. He was, I think, only 19 years old, Rene Lopez, and he was also murdered. And these are people that just were trying to get basic human rights for farm workers, like toilets in the fields, cold drinking water, unemployment insurance, the right to organize. This is what they were fighting for. But this is the kind of violence that they were met with. But, you know, at the inauguration of our lieutenant governor now, someone read the quote there about someone that went to heaven, and they were asked, "Let me see the scars. How many scars do you have? If you lived in this life and you had nothing to fight for and you had no scars, no wounds, then I'm not sure that you're ready to come to heaven." I may have totally misquoted that, but it's something like that. And so I think that that's something that people have to realize, especially in a democracy. I mean, we have in our country a democracy that we are very proud of. But we know that this democracy of ours cannot work, number one, if people don't engage. Number two, and this is your mission and ours, if people are not educated. And I often quote the Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset, who said that if we do not have an educated citizenry, then the country will be ruled by the greedy and the powerful. And so education, it's got to be the basis of our democracy. It's got to be the foundation of our democracy. And we've got to make sure that every single person in our country is educated, whether they're going to do farm work, carpenters, auto mechanics, college professors. You know, they need to have an education. And I think that's something we have to really, really fight very hard for.
I honor your sense of dignity, of names and stories of the martyrs. I think sometimes those are not written about in the textbooks. And I love that you honor their name, honor their story. What does that mean to give honor?
I think the way that we honor those that have fought for justice in the past is to make a commitment to fight for justice in our lives. I think that's the way we honor them. That's how we honor Dr. Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Cesar Chavez, Dorothy Day, you know, we have to think of the women, Coretta Scott King. You know, I think this is the way that we honor people, is by continuing their legacies and by doing the difficult work that we need to do in our communities, which means speaking out, which means recruiting others to come and join the March for Justice. And this is something that we have to do.
What I'm so excited about is even the opportunity to sit in your office at the Dolores Huerta Foundation. Can you tell our audience what the Dolores Huerta Foundation is currently fighting for? I think that's really important for them to understand how you keep evolving and you're still an activist and you're still willing to get arrested. I believe you've been arrested 22 times in what John Lewis would call fighting the good fight. So tell me, what are you fighting for today?
Well, we're fighting for empowerment of our local communities so that they can then fight for our kids. We want to stop the school-to-prison pipeline. We want everybody to give a good quality education. And not only quality, but we want an education that teaches all of our young children, number one, who built the United States of America, that it was African slaves that built the White House and the Congress, that it was immigrants to this country, not only the ones from Europe, but the ones from Mexico and the Philippines and China, the Japanese, people from India, that built the infrastructure of the United States of America. You know, it's so important that we get rid of the cancer of racism. And we want our local people that we organize to take the power in their communities to get on these school boards to make sure our kids have a good ethnic education and civic engagement education. You know, this is what we're fighting for. And to get good representation, not only at the local level, on our school boards, our city councils, but also in our state legislatures and in our Congress. We want a good social justice government is what we want. But we know we've got to do it by enabling and empowering people at the bottom to make them understand that they may not have a college education. Many of them do not have a high school education, but they have good common sense. They care about their communities. They can make the difference. You know, many people don't know that Cesar Chavez only went to the 8th grade.
I did not know that.
No, he didn't even go to high school, but he was a genius. And in the farm workers movement, when we had the, you know, I'm not with the union anymore. I left the union 15 years ago, but we had a lot of training programs. So we had farm workers who became lawyers. In fact, one of them is a local judge now, Marcos Camacho. He never went to college. He got his training as an attorney in the United Farm Workers. And so we have about six people that were boycott volunteers, young people, that became attorneys and are now serving in very high positions all over the country. I wish you could meet one of our leaders. Her name is Leticia Prado, and she sits on both the school board and the water board. And she never went to high school. She's an immigrant from Mexico, speaks very broken English, but has all of the meetings translated into Spanish so that not only she, but the people in the community can understand what's going on in these various meetings, right? And she's very, very powerful. When she first got on the school board, they were trying to get rid of the breakfast program for the farm worker kids because the principal, the superintendent thought it was too much paperwork. Well, needless to say, she got rid of that person and kept the breakfast program. When she got on, she got herself elected to the water district and vetted the new manager that they had hired and found out that he had been fired for embezzlement. So she got rid of him. And then she looked at all the bank records and found out that there was $250,000 missing from that water district. So she called in the grand jury. I mean, this is one person, one woman who never went to high school in the United States of America and speaks mostly Spanish, understands English, but her English is very broken, but she is a very powerful woman. And then we have a couple of people that just got recently elected that were part of our youth program. Our mayor of Arvin is only 25 years old, and he declared that the whole city of Arvin was not going to do any fracking. We are sitting right here in Kern County, which is the largest producer of oil in the state of California. And he said no fracking in my area, my city. Well, the oil companies put a lot of money into trying to defeat some of his council members. But guess what? He won. He kept his council members, and they were outspent like 10 to 1. So this is what it's all about. It's about people taking power, making sure that we have social justice policies, that we care about the environment, that we care about our youth. And that's what education's all about.
In our present day climate, a lot of these rights that people fought so hard for, like yourself, are in danger. What does that feel like? Are you going to organize more than ever because those rights that were given may be stripped away?
Well, it's an ongoing struggle, I think. It's not, and so we have to be vigilant We have to be vigilant, and we have to realize that this is an issue that is constant. You know, it's not something that's just today. It's got to be a lifelong struggle, and people have to have a commitment, and we do have to be vigilant. Democracy takes a lot of work. You've got to participate. You've got to be engaged. You've got to be knowledgeable about what's happening, what's going on.
I have a freedom writer who thinks of you as a superhero. Oh. You don't have a cape on today, mm-hmm. and you're not going to leap over a tall building. But as someone who was the first to graduate, the first to go to college, she studied Chicano studies, mm-hmm. and she's left a legacy along with the Freedom Riders with words. I'd love, Sue Ellen, in honor of being that young girl, trying to evolve into a wonderful woman like yourself. Maybe, Sue Ellen, you could, with just a statement about what she has done for the youth and for others that are activists.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's such an honor to sit here and watch you, because your message is so poignant and is so important that we all have a voice. We all need to stand up, not for just ourselves, but for each other. And to be able to right the wrongs, that's a beautiful thing, I think, with Ms. G, is she empowered me to realize how important education was to get me to break the cycle of abuse, to break the cycle of homelessness, to break that cycle of depending on someone else. And that's what I honor and I love about the women in my life. And you're one of the women in my life that show me that standing up and using your voice, you have to do it in order to help others. And so I applaud you and I honor you for doing that.
Thank you for that. So,
what I am envisioning is a teacher playing this podcast to her students for a reason, to make her students feel engaged and want to participate. So I want to start with a call to action first for the educator who wants to engage her young students, her middle school students, or even her high school students, he or she. What would you want to encourage an educator to do with that power?
I'm glad you said that, because I think a lot of teachers don't realize the power that they have, not only in the classroom with the parents, the students, but also in the community. And when I say this, I know that teachers are so overburdened with work. And I was a teacher. I have a daughter, Juanita, who was a teacher for like 14 years before she quit to come and join our foundation to work with us. But teachers have so much power, and they somehow got to find the time to exercise their power in the community also, because they have respected voices in our community. But the other thing, too, is you have demonstrated with the work that you've done, the power that you have over every student. You know, if students look up to the teachers so much, and every teacher can change a child's life. Every teacher can change a child's life. I'm going to tell a really quick story, if I can, about a young woman who had a difficult family situation, and so she was using drugs. Well, her high school teacher said to her in her senior year, "What college are you going to?" And she thought, college? That never even entered my mind. And she said, yeah, you should think about going to college. So she took her and a group of her friends and took them around to different colleges. And then she said, you should apply for a scholarship, an athletic scholarship. So she did. She stopped using drugs, got accepted, and now is the head of another college. So, I mean, this is just one teacher, one young woman. And you know, we know the teachers have so much influence. And also, in the classrooms, I say to educators, you know, show kids the story of Emmett Till, this young man who was murdered in Mississippi. Young man from Chicago who was murdered in Mississippi because they said he was a little white woman, you know. Show the movie about Matthew Shepard, a young student who was murdered because he was gay. You know, show the movies about Cesar Chavez and Dr. King, Martin Luther King, you know, the freedom struggles and the Holocaust, like you did to your students, you know. This is the way that we teach our children. This is a real education that our young people need, and about the labor woman and about the women's movement. This is a real education that they need. They need an education about social justice. And this is how teachers can be the most powerful force in our country.
As a mother of 11, mm-hmm. Let's talk to parents. You would go into those homes, and these mothers and fathers probably served you on their finest china if they had it, and probably cooked the best meals that they could. So let's galvanize parents. What would you say to those parents that house to house, 6 to 8 people, what can they do? What should they do? And how could you be a catalyst for change for them?
Well, when we organize our parents, the message that we give them is that you need to be involved in your school. And you need to be at those meetings when the budget is being presented. We have the budgets translated into Spanish so that people can examine the budgets and to make sure that the money is being appropriated the way that it should. We give them recommendations of things that they need to do at their school. And luckily, a lot of our recommendations are being accepted. And some of them are challenged. We had one recently challenged at one of our places, the California City, where the Board of Education actually supported the parents against the school district. So parents, again, have a lot of power, but they need to be taught how a school system works, and this is what we do. We have a whole program where we come in and we organize the parents. We set up an education committee in every chapter where we organize. The parents are then educated. We also have the disciplinary procedures. We have a manual that's been translated into in Spanish also so that they will know what the procedures are to teach them how to fight for their kids so they won't be suspended and expelled. So it's a lot of work, but it's a work that is very necessary and needs to be done.
I want to conclude with a young Dolores in a classroom somewhere in the world. May or may not be documented, may or may not have a nuclear home, may or may not have the confidence that you had as that Girl Scout. Speak to her. What would you want that young girl listening to this podcast to feel or want to do or evolve into becoming?
Well, I would share with that young girl the messages that my mother shared with me, because I was actually very shy. People may not believe that now, but my mother always said to me, number one, always be yourself. You don't have to pretend that you're anybody else. You know, always be proud of who you are. Always speak up. Even if you think you're going to be saying the wrong thing, if you say the wrong thing, it can always be corrected. But always have that courage to speak up, not only for yourself, but speak up for others. If you have an idea, be sure and express that idea, even if you're not confident when you say it. Especially with a women's movement, we have to say to our young women, not only be proud of who you are, take credit for what you do. Take credit for what you do. And I think that's very hard for young women to do that because we're so used to just being accommodating and letting other people take credit for our work, you know. We have to just build up our own inner courage and know that we as women are important, especially now that we see that we have so many great women leaders, you know, in the different movements and our legislatures, and the world needs women's voices. I say we have a different intuition, we have a different way of thinking, but we should never be afraid to speak out. These are great lessons for women.
Let's end with Cissé Poitier is about yes, you can. Mm-hmm. What can we do now?
Well, if we can remember that si se puede actually can be interpreted in two ways. It can be interpreted to say yes, I can, but then it can also be interpreted as yes, we can. The important thing is to remember that we can't do it alone, that we have to recruit people to help us, and never be afraid to try to talk to someone else. And even if they reject your message at that point, it's because they're just not ready for it. But we have to keep on trying. And if that person doesn't want to join the movement for social justice, for educational justice, if they don't want to join the movement now, well, let's come back to them later, but we'll go on to the next person because somebody out there will be ready to hear the message. The main thing is to explain to them that we can all make it happen together. If we all work together, we can make it happen. And that's what Cissé Poitier means.
Thank you to Dolores and the entire Dolores Huerta Foundation for generously allowing us entry into this sacred space. I hope that Dolores' words of encouragement empower you to become a catalyst for change. While making a movement may feel difficult, as Dolores says, every teacher can change a child's life and everyone can make a difference. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruo. Our producer and editor is Bryce Cyrier, and our associate producer is Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.